Quincy raised excellent questions. I sure as hell don't believe Russell Lee did it. That leaves us with your family, as you know. They do have motive.
The money, she said flatly and stood herself. The subject was too aggravating to handle sitting. The $1 million life insurance policy.
Better than that. We think your mother and Jamie O'Donnell might have been having an affair back then.
What?
Police notes. O'Donnell was spending a lot of time around the house, and your parents were having a lot of marital difficulties. Screaming matches, that kind of thing.
Melanie shook her head. My parents don't scream at each other. They have discussions behind closed doors.
Yeah, well, back then they were fighting enough to attract the notice of the hired help and friends. Seems that your father wasn't very faithful.
He flirts a lot. She held up a hand and conceded. Maybe he does more than flirt, but as strange as this sounds, I don't think my mom minds. I've always had the impression she accepts my father's job and lifestyle as male prerogative. Boys will be boys.
What's good for the goose?
Melanie pursed her lips, not liking this newest allegation. But these days, there seemed to be more she didn't know about her family than she did. She moved to the coffee table and picked up the hotel pad that revealed her work for the day.
Then we come to your brother,
David said.
Brian was 9 years old.
And troubled enough to be seeing a shrink. Plus your mom herself had given the nanny orders not to leave him alone with Megan. He seemed to be very jealous of her, and very destructive of her toys. Remember, he said that he'd thrown her toy pony against the fireplace. So now we have money, love, and mental instability, all running in your family. But here's a twist. I did full background checks on your family, and there is simply nothing to suggest they're capable of murdering a 4-year-old girl.
Melanie nodded vigorously and waved her notepad in the air.
Exactly. Look here. I wrote down what Quincy said about the person who did the crime, and I've done a little analysis of my own. I've been arguing that my family couldn't do it because I loved them so much. Since that doesn't carry weight in criminal investigations, I decided to look at it your way.
She sat down on the sofa and placed the notepad on the coffee table. David took a seat next to her. She could feel the warmth of his body against her leg. She spoke faster and kept her eyes on the diagram. Here is Megan and my family. Here is what we know about everyone's relationship, and here is what we know about each individual. I was thinking of what Quincy said about profiling, that you look at the psychology under the behavior. I'm not sure I can objectively say that my parents are good or bad people, but I believe I can objectively say if they are smart or precise or sloppy.
Okay,
David said, studying her picture.
I can grant you that much.
Here is what Quincy said about the person who killed Megan Stokes. The person is precise and knowledgeable about police procedure. Then the person has to be clever enough and credible enough to approach Megan. Also, I guess the person has to be tough enough to deal with the likes of Russell Lee Holmes. At the same time, however, the person is maternal, at least caring and remorseful enough to wrap Megan in a blanket and bury the body. He'd also have to feel guilty for what he did. Guilty enough to, well, decapitate her. Even on paper, that aspect of the crime still horrified her. She swallowed, and not wanting to lose momentum, for she clearly had David's full attention, she wrapped the pencil tip against her diagram. Now, that's a unique combination of traits. Distinct, wouldn't you say? So let's look at our players. We have my father, who is very precise and smart. But frankly, as much as I love him, I can tell you he's not maternal. Hugs and kisses are definitely my mother's department. As for knowledge of police procedure, I don't think my father has even gotten a speeding ticket in his life. He doesn't watch cop dramas or read true crime, so I think he's a total washout there. Plus, tough enough to approach and or intimidate Russell Lee Holmes? Please. The man can't bear to go a week without a manicure. Russell Lee would eat him alive. So what about my mother? Now she fits for being maternal, remorseful, and guilty. But do you really think my mother is precise? Haven't you ever seen how hard her hands shake? And while I think she's an intelligent woman, she's not this kind of clever, let alone knowledgeable about police procedure. And there really is no way she would ever approach a man like Russell Lee. Can you imagine that? She doesn't fit either. Now my godfather.
I'll be honest, I've always had the impression that Jamie knows things. He has a way of moving, you know? If you're a female he loves, it's very reassuring, like spending time around the tough kid in school. He grew up hard, and I imagine he could intimidate a man like Russell Lee Holmes, and he probably knows something about law enforcement. But Jamie isn't precise. He's blunt, physical, and rough around the edges. Also, I can't see Jamie harming a little girl. In his world, that would be dishonorable, I guess. He could be cruel to someone who threatened someone he loved, but he'd cut off his own hand before he'd harm a child. Actually, he's even a little maternal toward kids. Certainly, he's affectionate and loving toward Brian and me. He's just not that combination of cold, precise callousness. Then we have my brother.
He's a doctor,
David interjected.
So he must be precise.
At the age of 9? And what would he know about police procedure, David? And how in the world would a 9-year-old convince Russell Lee to confess to a crime he didn't commit? Don't you see? She turned, looking at him earnestly. There is no one on this page who fits what Quincy is looking for. I'm not an expert, true, but put it this level, it doesn't work. The killer simply isn't my family. End of story.
Melanie finally relaxed, but then David took her chart from her. He took her pencil. He drew a few lines, and that easily he burst her bubble.
You're right, Melanie,
he said simply.
You're absolutely right. Alone, no one individual meets all the requirements. And that's what the message has been all along. I was a fool not to see it earlier. It's not one person who's getting notes, it's all of them. And if you put them all together,
he looked her in the eye.
Your mother, father, brother, or godfather could not have committed this crime. But this family, on the other hand.
No, Melanie said.
Yes, he replied. I'm sorry, Melanie, but yes.
She had to get off the sofa. She paced around the room a few times, her thoughts in turmoil.
It's the combination,
David murmured, making quick notes and seeming to speak almost to himself.
As individuals, they fail. But as a group, they cover all the traits and areas of knowledge needed to carry out the crime. Harper devising the ransom demand, covering up with the idea to make it a copycat crime. Your guilt-stricken mother wrapping up Megan's body. Your godfather disposing of it, I think, and handling the deal with Russell Lee Holmes when the police started asking too many questions. Getting Russell Lee to confess to Megan's murder in return for your family providing a home for his own child. Think of how much Russell Lee would have liked that. A lifetime of hating poverty, and one day he gets an offer to transport his child to the upper class. What a deal.
But the murder, Melanie protested. No one is cruel enough to commit the murder. You said yourself no one is cruel enough to commit the murder.
David looked up, his expression distracted. She realized with a start that this had become an academic exercise for him, a riddle for the great agent to figure out.
She was shocked. What if it wasn't murder, Melanie? What if it was an accident? What if little Brian Stokes simply went too far with his jealous rampage one day?
Oh, God,
she whispered in horror.
Think about it, Melanie. 9-year-old Brian. He harms Megan out of jealousy or rage, and what do your parents do? They've already lost one child.
No.
Your godfather also seems loyal to him. Plus, he'd probably do anything to keep Patricia from suffering more. Finally, we have a situation worthy of the three adults getting over their differences and working together.
But the decapitation, the mutilation.
Maybe they had to. Quincy said decapitation can also be about covering up a crime. They're trying to imitate a killer who strangles his victims. But what if it was an accident that killed Megan? Maybe she fell down the stairs, maybe she was hit in the head. They must decapitate her, or the real cause of death will be determined. If she was hit with a blunt instrument, there might even be paint or fiber or metallic particles buried in the wound that could be used to trace the murder weapon. So in for a dime, in for a dollar. They decapitate the body, remove the hands to hide other wounds or physical evidence, and devise a plot to imitate some serial killer they've been reading about in the paper.
Melanie was shaking her head.
But the police aren't convinced,
David continued.
Harper doesn't know enough details, so his copycat attempt fails. Then Russell Lee is arrested. So they decide to go straight to the source. Jamie pays him a visit, and they strike a deal. David looked at her somberly. I'm sorry, Melanie, but that scenario works. You are Russell Lee Holmes's child, and they took you in the night he died to cover up what happened to Megan 5 years before.
You're wrong, Melanie kept repeating.
She had wrapped her arms tightly around her waist, and her voice came out sounding more desperate than she'd intended. David rose off the sofa. There was a look in his eyes Melanie had never seen before. Maybe tenderness, maybe compassion. He took her hands, and then, in a move she didn't expect, he drew her against his body and pressed her cheek against his chest. She realized for the first time that she was trembling uncontrollably, and then he whispered roughly against her temple.
Maybe. But there's no arguing that Larry Digger was killed, or that shots were aimed at you.
She collapsed. Her knees buckled, and she would have fallen if David hadn't already been holding her. Her hands grabbed his shirt for support. Her body sagged into him, and he gripped her tighter.
It's going to be all right, David whispered against her hair. I won't let them hurt you. I won't let anyone hurt you.
My family, I love them.
She buried her head against his shoulder and held on tight. The storm lasted a bit. Gradually, she was aware of David leading her over to the couch. He lay down with her, wrapping his lean body around her. He stroked her hair, her back. Then his lips brushed her cheek, the curve of her ear. Tender. Soft. She turned to him savagely, caught his lips full force with her own and kissed him hard. Lips bruising, lips, teeth smashing, breath labored. She arched against him, tried to bury herself in the feel and taste and sensation. He ravaged her totally, his tongue plunging into her mouth, filling her, making her whole. Then, when her breasts were swollen and her nipples tingling and her whole body restless and writhing, he pulled away. She could hear his ragged breathing and the racing beat of his heart. She could see that his hands trembled.
No more, he said roughly.
Why not?
Because it wouldn't be right. I want it to be right.
He got off the couch in a hurry, obviously realizing that she was in no mood to be denied, and he was in no shape to win. The front of his slacks bulged with his erection, and he had to fist his hands in his back pockets to keep from reaching for her again. Melanie contemplated forcing the issue. He wanted her, and she needed to be wanted by anyone. But he was right. She was too desperate, and she'd hate them both later. She rose from the sofa and walked to the window.
They've never harmed me, David. They've been so good to me.
He didn't answer. Minute ticked into minute.
The police should find the shooter soon,
David said at last.
Once we get our hands on him, he'll be able to tell us a thing or two.
Such as who hired him.
Exactly.
And then we'll know.
Exactly.
Okay,
she said. Okay. David raised his arms above his head and stretched out his back.
I gotta get some sleep.
I know.
You gonna stay up? Will you be okay?
I'll be fine.
We're going to get to the bottom of it,
he said again.
We will.
Melanie simply smiled. She wasn't so sure herself anymore, and she was wondering if there were some truths that should never be known. David moved toward the bedroom. Then he stopped and turned, his gaze unreadable.
You know,
he said quietly,
you don't need them as much as you think you do. You're stronger than you know.
What does that have to do with the fact that I love them?
David didn't have a reply. Melanie stayed up long into the night. She sat on the sofa with her knees pulled up against her chest and her arms wrapped around her legs. She thought of her parents and her brother and her godfather, the way that they had held her and made her laugh and doted on her, the way they had lavished their time and attention on her, as if she were a long-awaited present that was finally theirs at last. Right before she fell asleep, she thought, if I really am Russell Lee Holmes's daughter, why did Quincy say my memories of the shack weren't right? And if all this was done to protect Brian, Wouldn't it matter that he's now been disinherited from the family? The shooter, she thought groggily. The shooter will tell. But there was no such luck. The next morning, she and David awoke to the hotel phone ringing. It was Detective Jax. He'd found the shooter, all right. Unfortunately, the man was dead. 21.
It won't be pleasant,
David warned. Melanie merely nodded, keeping her gaze out the passenger side window, where semis barreled down Highway 93 and distant factories emitted plumes of smoke. They were approaching the Harbor District of Boston. She caught the first whiff of salt.
Jax said he was in the water,
David said.
That always makes it look worse. Really, Melanie, you should wait until the body has been processed. You can ID it by video at the morgue.
But it won't be ready until tomorrow morning, correct?
Boston Homicide is a little overworked.
Then I'll do it now, she reasserted firmly, as she'd been saying since they first got the call. If it's him and he's dead, then I can go home. No sense in delaying that any longer than necessary.
Why don't we hold off on any quick decisions?
David said vaguely, which was enough to let her know he was going to make an issue out of it. She shot him a quick glance, but he refused to meet her gaze. Obviously, he didn't want to engage in the discussion then. Fine. It could wait until she saw the body. It wouldn't change her mind. She had spent a lot of time thinking since last night and formed some opinions of her own. She turned back to the car window. The exit appeared on their right, and David careened across three lanes of traffic to take it. One tourist honked. No one else seemed to notice. The wharf came into view. As crime scenes went, this one was hard to miss. Black and white police cruisers peppered the scene. Yellow crime tape draped across the road. One beefy officer had adopted an aggressive stance outside the perimeter and was waving them away until David flashed his creds. Like membership in an elite club, the FBI shield entitled them to a first-class viewing of a dead man. They pulled in next to two dark sedans and one old clunker. David opened her door for her. She realized he always did that, even held out chairs. His mother's doing, she thought, and accepted his hand to pull herself out of the car. When he held out his arm for her, however, she shook her head. She preferred to walk this path alone. They crossed to a group of plainclothes detectives and one medical examiner. The air was tangy with the scent of salt and underlined with the heavy sweetness of rot. This area of Boston's harbor was far from scenic, and Melanie had never spent much time down here. There was an old fish packaging plant that had seen better days. The dark, oily water was stagnant with dead fish, fallen seagulls, and today, a man's corpse. In spite of all of David's warnings, Melanie recoiled at the smell. Detective Jax turned to greet them. He once again worked a toothpick between his teeth, giving David a firm handshake and Melanie a sympathetic smile.
How you doing, Miss Stokes?
No one shot me yet. I must be doing better than Monday. Detective Jax flashed a grin, then grew serious.
Just so you're prepared, it's not pretty.
David warned me.
Sure you don't want to wait for the morgue tape?
As I've said.
Okay, I got it. You're tired of club fed and you want to go home. Fine, then, here's the drill. You don't have to memorize him or nothing. Just take a glance. Tell us if you think it's him. One look, you're done.
Go home and forget all about it? She murmured. Then followed Detective Jax to the body. David rested his hand on the small of her back. There was no mistaking the dead man. He was face up on the cracked asphalt. Puffed face, gray and rubbery. Floated hands over his head. Picked ragged by feeding fish. Dark suit, waterlogged and algae-coated. Black holes on his white dress shirt where two bullets had fired home. No blood this time. The water had washed it away.
What do you think?
Detective Jax asked. That's him. She kept staring. She couldn't help herself. Dead never looked the way she thought it should. With Digger, it had been too bloody. With this man, it was too alien. The water had turned him into something resembling a wax doll.
Looks like he'd been shot twice, close range,
Detective Jax said conversationally.
Probably the day before. It's gonna take a bit to ID him. No papers and not much for fingerprints. Guess the fish had a real banquet. We'll send him to the state crime lab for analysis. The water will make it tougher. He's a floater and a bloater, but I've requested Jeffrey Ames for the job. Jeff's the best. I know Jeff.
David spoke up.
He's good. You know Jeff.
Detective Jack switched the toothpick to the left side of his mouth and peered at David curiously.
I'm a member of the Mass Rifle Association,
David explained.
Jeff shoots there, too. You're a member of the MRA. Wait a sec. David Riggs. Are you Bobby Riggs' son?
David nodded. Detective Jack's lit up.
Holy hell, good to meet you. I love Bobby. Man does beautiful work. Give your father my regards, okay? Oh, and tell him I want to bring in my gun. Damn sight is driving me nuts. I'll tell him. When do you think you'll have the initial report? 48 hours, maybe. I'm gonna put a rush on it. But we're a little backed up these days. Spring's rough around here.
Do you know who killed him? Melanie asked quietly. Her stomach was beginning to roll.
Don't have any witnesses, if that's what you mean. We're still detailing the area, but so far no brass and no traces of blood. So he was probably shot somewhere else. Lab guys may find something on his shoes or clothing that can help us locate the murder site. It's amazing what a couple of good chemists can do these days.
What about the notes he took? The papers from Larry Digger's room? Detective Jax shook his head.
Nope. My guess is he showed up for contact, delivering the goods and expecting to get paid. But maybe his employer wasn't so happy about the mess he made of things, or the job being only half done. So he closed out the deal with a couple of deliveries of lead. There just ain't no honor among thieves.
So we don't really know anything yet, Melanie murmured. Sure, this person is dead, but his employer could just hire another and another and... Her voice was rising. She was losing it after all. David and Detective Jax were watching her closely. She took a deep breath, focused on the warm, familiar feel of David's hand against the small of her back. She nodded and everyone relaxed.
You guys care to start explaining things yet? Detective Jax asked. Or should I just wait until the next dead body? I don't know,
David replied.
When are you planning on finding the next dead body? Oh, holy lord, working with G-men sucks.
Jax spat out his toothpick.
Look, I'm going after this with all I can, Agent Riggs. I don't have the resources of the Bureau or the experts of the Bureau. But what the hell? I like to think us poor local slobs run a pretty good show. Now, do you want to give me any hints, or should I just keep gnawing away at this like a chihuahua?
Larry Digger said he had proof of who my birth parents are, Melanie offered. It seems someone doesn't want me to know.
Why? Everyone's finding their birth parents these days. It's about as popular as no-fat double lattes with whip.
Because maybe my birth father was a serial killer, and maybe it would be embarrassing for my family if it was discovered that they had knowingly adopted the child of such a man. Now she had Detective Jax's undivided attention.
Well, shoot me, that would make a difference. So there's Larry Digger. He claimed to have proof of where you came from?
That's what he said. We never got to see it, but we heard quite a bit of his story.
And he let your parents knowingly adopted you anyway. They got big hearts or what? I didn't think the Beacon Street type liked to go outside established bloodlines.
Jax gave her a look.
Miss Stokes, I can dance as well as the next guy, but this tango is ridiculous. If you want me to help, you give it to me clean. I'll see what I can do. Welcome to the Jax School of Justice, Kay.
Needless to say,
David said smoothly.
It's an ongoing investigation. Listen, detective. If you want to help, here's what we need the most. Our shooter is dead. But we still don't know who hired him. And since the job wasn't completed the first time, there's a good chance that there will be a second contract on Melanie's life. If you hear anything, I think I'll let you know.
Jax returned to Melanie, shaking his head.
I'll work on this as hard as I can. And you got Mr. Personality here, too, but these things take time. It'll be days before I get the first lab report, and that's assuming the initial chem run yields findings. With bodies that have been in the water, it can take longer than that. I can already tell the bullets are soft lead, so they won't have any striations, which means the lab will have to determine gun type by class, not characteristic. That takes longer as well. Seriously, ma'am, we're looking at weeks before we start getting the first clue, and considering that you're already in danger,
he's right,
David said, having found an ally for his case.
I'll take you back to the hotel, Melanie. We'll buy you clothes, come up with a good excuse for your parents. Hell, you can tell them you're off to find yourself. That's true enough. and it would certainly be a lot safer.
No.
Yes.
No. I know who I am, David. I'm 29 years old. I have lived the last 20 years in the Stokes household, and that is where I belong.
Like hell it is. They are going to get you killed.
You don't know that. We don't have a shred of evidence, just a bunch of far-fetched theories. I'm not going to walk away because of that. For crying out loud, we are never going to move beyond theory with me shut up in a hotel room anyway. At the very least, you consider my going home as the most efficient means of moving the investigation forward.
I will not risk you for the stupid case.
This isn't your choice, David. It's mine, and I'm going home. She pivoted, took a step toward the car, but David grabbed her arm.
Don't you put yourself in the line of fire.
They won't hurt me, she insisted stubbornly. They won't.
You are blind and stubborn and completely ignorant when it comes to your parents. You're so caught up in your romantic notion of what families mean that you're going to get yourself killed.
Why, thank you, David. I trust your judgment and intelligence just as much. She jerked her arm free and stormed back to the car. Detective Jax let out a low whistle.
I guess we pissed her off. She doesn't understand. The woman is standing in front of a corpse. I think she understands just fine. No, she doesn't.
David turned on Jax.
You don't get her yet, Detective. She was abandoned, and that has skewed her judgment. Her family is perfect. Her family must need her. It's a great dream, an understandable dream, and it's gonna get her killed.
Detective Jax shrugged.
And if it were your family, Riggs? If it was your father we were talking about? Who would be the naive romantic then? Oh, shut up,
David said darkly and stalked after Melanie to the car. They drove downtown in taut silence, David tapping his fingers crossly on the wheel while Melanie stared resolutely out the window.
You are a pig-headed fool,
he said finally. She smiled tightly.
I believe it runs in the family.
They made it another half mile, then he exploded again.
Damn it, you can't ignore the fact that someone wants you dead.
I'm not ignoring it.
You're walking into the proverbial lion's den.
No, I'm not. I'm going home, which is my right. I'm going to kiss my mother on the cheek, I'm going to hug my father, I'm going to hunt down my brother for a serious heart-to-heart, and then I'm going to corner my godfather for a nice long chat.
Because you believe they'll magically tell you everything?
His voice lowered with scorn.
Whatever happened to Megan, they've kept it secret for 25 years. Now someone has even gone so far as to hire a paid gun. So really, I don't think they're going to simply confess. Not even to their favorite daughter.
Melanie drew in her breath with a sharp hiss.
They are not evil.
Close enough. Damn it, Melanie.
David suddenly slapped the steering wheel.
Are you going to make me say it?
Maybe.
I'm an agent. It's out of line.
Then I'll take it off the record, Mr. Riggs.
He growled, but she didn't relent. She had not realized how much this mattered to her until right that moment. She was leaning toward him. She was staring at him intently. She'd come to need him even more than she'd realized. She really wanted to know that he cared as well, that the last few days had not been another illusion. He spoke in a rush.
I care, damn it. You matter to me, Melanie, more than you're supposed to, and I don't want to see you hurt.
I know.
I sympathize, all right? They're your family, and while I certainly won't win Son of the Year award anytime soon, my family is important to me, too. If it was my father or brother in question, I don't know that I would handle it any better.
I have to trust them, David. They've loved me so well.
Of course they've loved you, Mel. You're as close to Megan Stokes as they're ever going to get.
Melanie recoiled. She knew he was trying to shock her, and it worked. Her eyes were stinging. She was on the verge of tears. There wasn't anyone in the world who didn't long to be loved for simply being herself. It wasn't fair of him to state that no matter what she did, she would always be the substitute daughter. She turned away and looked out the window. David got off 93, whipped through the financial district, and emerged on Beacon Street. 3 blocks from home. He slowed down the car. She groped for her composure. When he finally stopped the car, she still didn't feel ready.
Be careful, he said quietly.
The scowl had dropped. He looked genuinely worried, and that touched her.
Thank you.
She brushed his hand. He pulled it back, shaking his head.
I don't want your gratitude. I'm too far over the line to even pretend this is professional courtesy.
Yeah, it's part of your charm.
I don't have any charm. I'm old, arthritic, and cranky. Half the time I have the personality of a porcupine. Don't tell me I have charm.
You do. Because underneath it all I know there beats a good heart.
Female fantasy,
he muttered. Truth. He looked like he might argue some more. But then he sighed, and now he did take her hand with his own.
Melanie. For lots of reasons, I think you know I can't just stop by your house.
I expected that.
You really will be on your own.
I understand that, too.
And you're scaring the shit out of me.
Given.
Okay, fine. This is my beeper number.
He scrawled it on a piece of paper.
If you're in trouble, I'll come. Have a bad dream, I'll come. Have a bad memory, I'll come. Just dial the beeper, okay? I'll be there, Melanie. I will.
She took the piece of paper. Thank you, she said, and saw him wince once more at her gratitude. I need to go now.
Mel, wait.
But Melanie didn't wait. She slipped out of the car. She started walking and didn't look back, not even when the car started up and drove away. Then she was alone. The cherry blossoms waved merrily. The scent of hyacinths was spicy and fragrant in the air. A beautiful day in a beautiful city. Melanie looked up at the 3-story brick house that was her home. She saw the solid walnut doors, the heavy iron gate. She saw the bay windows of her bedroom. And for just a moment, she shivered with fear. Then she opened the door and stepped inside. 22. Maria, the maid, greeted her with a friendly nod. She looked at Melanie's wrinkled clothes and disheveled hair, but took them in stride. Her parents and Signor O'Donnell were on the back patio eating lunch. Would she like anything? Melanie shook her head and headed for the patio. Jamie came walking through the back door. He halted at the sight of her, his face registering surprise.
Melanie?
Her godfather said hesitantly, holding out his arms as he always did, but clearly uncertain. She went into the hug, realizing she needed the contact more than she thought. Before she was ready, he pulled back and held her firmly at arm's length.
What's up, lass? I hear you've been gone for 2 days without so much as a buyer leave. Why are you worrying your mother like this? It's not like you.
Melanie didn't answer immediately. Confronted by her first family member, she discovered she wasn't sure what she wanted to say, or maybe she wasn't sure what she wanted to hear. David was right. This was more difficult than she thought. Her first question caught even her by surprise.
Do you love me? Of course, lass. You are my favorite woman in the whole world.
Why?
Why?
Her godfather arched a brow and regarded her more seriously.
You are in a mood. Well, I don't know. Why do you love anything, Melanie? I suppose because you do.
Is it? You've always been there for me, Jamie. For my homecoming party, my first day of school, my birthdays, my charity balls, everything. That's a lot of interest in a goddaughter's life.
Well, you are a special goddaughter.
But why? Why do you love me so much, Jamie? What is it you want from me? Her voice was rising a notch. Her godfather immediately waved away her distress. He said simply and calmly,
I love you for being you, and all I've ever wanted was for you to be happy.
Melanie thought it was one of the loveliest things she'd ever heard, and a heartbeat later she knew she didn't believe a word of it. For the first time in her life, she doubted her godfather. Moments passed, the silence growing strained. Jamie's expression changed from tender to wary.
If something was going on with you,
he finally asked,
you would let me know, wouldn't you?
I don't know. If something was going on with you, you would let me know, wouldn't you?
No, I wouldn't.
Why? I'm 29, I'm ready to hear.
And I'm 59, which is still older than you and wiser.
Wiser about what, Jamie? Wiser about a reporter named Larry Digger? Or a midwife to Russell Lee Holmes? Wiser about Brian and Megan Stokes? Her godfather studied her. His eyes, she realized, were much more sharp,
much more knowing than she'd ever given him credit for.
"Not Ryan,"
he said.
"But you, lass, you."
"Jamie." He moved away, making a show of dusting off his trench coat, flicking at lint.
"I'm going to be in town a bit, Melanie. Business is booming. What can I say? So if you need anything, of course."
He looked at her meaningfully.
"Call me at the Four Seasons. Day or night, I'll come."
"Jamie."
"I've met a woman, Mel. Have I told you that? I'm thinking of settling down, maybe becoming a local. What do you think? Can you see me as a married man?" "Bah. You're right, you're right. What am I doing looking at myself as a family man? That's Harper's gig, you know. Pipe dreams again. I'm getting maudlin and foolish in me old age."
"Jamie, at the Four Seasons.
Just call the number and your old godfather will be here. Now try to get some sleep."
Then he was gone. After a minute, Melanie opened the French doors and walked onto the patio. Her parents were dining alone. Harper was wearing hospital scrubs and reading the paper. He must have had a surgery this morning. Patricia sat across from him, sectioning out bites of grapefruit, which she followed with nibbles of dry toast. For as long as Melanie could remember, her mother had dined on only grapefruit and plain wheat toast. Patricia turned at the sound of Melanie's approach, and her eyes grew wide. They looked at each other uncomfortably, memories of a phone call stretching between the two of them. Melanie had never felt awkward around her mother, but now she did. Finally, Patricia smiled tremulously and held out her arms for her daughter's embrace. Melanie's knees almost gave way. This was what she wanted, she realized. After the last 48 hours, she wanted to come home to her mother. She wanted to inhale the scents of Chanel No. 5 and Lancome face cream she'd known most of her life. She wanted to hear her mother say, as she had so many times over the years, "It'll be all right, child. You're Stokes now, and we'll always take care of you." And then Melanie thought, "Oh, God. What did you people do to Megan?"
"How was your evening?"
Patricia asked lightly. "Fine," Melanie said. She stared at the patio floor, then fingered the petals of a pink climbing rose. Her mother's arms finally came down. She turned back to her grapefruit, shaken, and Melanie felt worse. Her father lowered his newspaper. He looked at her, then at Patricia, then her again. He frowned.
"Melanie, are you all right? We haven't seen you in days, which is not like you."
"I just needed some space."
"That may be, but we're still family. Next time, make sure you call. That's common courtesy."
"Of course," she murmured. How is life around here?"
"Busy,"
her father said with a sigh. He looked pale and overworked, his face showing his age.
"Got called in this morning for another pacemaker installation. I swear that hospital never lets me get any rest."
"Your father and I have been talking," her mother interjected suddenly. "We think it's time the whole family went on vacation. Even Brian."
"Europe,"
Harper said. "What?" Melanie couldn't have been more surprised.
"I've always said we should take a family vacation," her father continued reasonably. "Finally, I said to your mother that maybe we should just pack our bags and go. We'll spend 6 months traveling around France and England and the Mediterranean. It will be the time of our life." She was bewildered.
"I don't want to go to Europe. Not now."
"Nonsense,"
her mother said. Melanie thought her voice was too bright, as if she were placating a child.
"You need a vacation, Melanie. You deserve one. It will be wonderful. We'll relax and bask in the sun."
Melanie shook her head. She looked at her parents, but they wouldn't return her gaze. Patricia was wringing her hands on her lap, then twisting her wedding band. Harper was tapping his foot, shifting a bit to the left, shifting to the right, in a way she'd never seen her father do before. This wasn't a vacation, Melanie realized. This was escape. Had they gotten a shrine? Or maybe a phone call telling them they got what they deserved? Were they panicking and resorting to fleeing once more as they'd fled from Texas to Boston?
"I won't go,"
Melanie announced. Harper frowned.
We're offering you a vacation to Europe, Melanie. Of course you'll go.
She shook her head. Her hands were knotted at her sides, and she realized as she spoke that her voice was climbing.
This has nothing to do with a vacation. You never go on vacation, Dad. One would think if you spent more than 10 minutes away from your precious hospital, you'd turn to stone.
Her father's gaze narrowed.
I don't know what you're talking about, young lady, nor do I appreciate your tone.
I'm talking about the truth, Melanie cried. I'm talking about what happened to a little girl named Megan Stokes.
A silence descended upon the patio. Melanie saw her mother pale. Then the silence was broken by the sound of metal screeching on flagstone as her father pushed back his chair and leaped to his feet, his face an unhealthy shade of red.
Don't you dare, young lady. Don't you dare bring this up in front of your mother.
Why not? It's been 25 years. Why don't we ever speak of Megan? It's not like you guys don't think about her, or that I don't find Mom staring at her portrait, or you yourself gazing at it over a glass of scotch. Brian still calls out her name at times. Jamie used to stutter every time he had to say Melanie. Megan's here. She's in this house, and she's part of all of our lives. So why don't we ever speak of her? What are you so afraid of?
Young lady, that is enough. You will not speak to your parents like that.
My parents. Yes, my parents. One more thing we never mention. Why didn't we ever look for my birth parents, Dad? Why didn't you ever suggest hypnosis or regression therapy or anything that might help me reclaim my own identity? Why were you at the hospital that night and not watching the execution of Russell Lee Holmes?
Melanie!
Her mother gasped.
What is this?
Melanie didn't get a chance to answer. Harper thrust up a hand, immediately silencing his wife. He stared at his daughter, and there was a cold expression on his face Melanie had never seen turned on her before.
How dare you?
His gaze burned the way it had when he'd looked at her brother the night Brian had announced he was gay.
How dare you stand in my own house and speak to me this way, after everything I've done for you? God damn it, I took you in. I put a roof over your head. I've done everything a father is supposed to do. Looked after your health, paid for your education, guided you through life. I've never shortchanged you, young lady. I have never treated you as less than my own child, you spoiled, ungrateful.
What? Melanie goaded softly. Killer's brat? Is that what you're trying to say? Is that how you really feel, Harper?
You little bitch!
He raised his arm and smacked her hard. Melanie fell onto the patio without even a murmur. As if from a distance, she heard her mother's soft cry of distress. Slowly, Melanie raised her head.
It's not going to go away, Dad, she whispered. The truth is out now, and not even Boston's best cardiac surgeon can control this mess. Not even you can make it go away.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Stop it! Patricia yelled. Just stop it!
They both turned to her. Patricia was getting shakily to her feet. Her body swayed tremulously, her eyes filled with unshed tears.
Please, she whispered. No more. This is our daughter, Harper. Brian is our son. They are all we have. What are you doing?
I'm trying to teach them some gratitude. You see what happens when you give them everything, Pat? How they are both turning out.
Patricia placed a hand on his shoulder.
Harper, please.
He yanked his arm away, his expression too angry, too hurt.
You too, Pat,
he growled.
God damn it, I have had enough. Who bought this house and the cars you're driving and the clothes you're wearing and the food you're eating anyway? Certainly wasn't you or your father. He left all his money to charity, remember? Told us we could earn ours. So I did. I go to that hospital every day. I work my ass off in a stressful position you couldn't even imagine. And what kind of respect do I get for that? What kind of appreciation for my own wife?
He whirled on Melanie.
And you. Your charity work is great. But how the hell does it pay the rent? What kind of responsibility do you show around here? You just went off for 2 days as if you hadn't a fucking care in the world. Now what would happen if I did that? Huh? What would happen? Don't you people get it yet? My own children dance and play and join freak shows while I pay the fucking bills. My wife shops and nurses her self-pity while I get up and go to work every single day regardless of rain, weather, or mood. Jesus Christ, Pat. All I ever asked of you was to be a good mother. Then Megan dies and you weren't even that. You became a mourner. A full-time professional mourner. Is it any wonder that Brian became a freak? Of course he had to turn to men. It wasn't like he was getting any affection from the women in his life.
Patricia inhaled sharply, but her husband was far from done.
So don't you turn on me.
He stared directly at Melanie.
Don't you speak to me in that tone of voice. This is my house. Paid for by me. Maintained by me, because that's what my life is all about. Taking care of the rest of you whether I feel like it or not. You guys get to play. I have never had that luxury. Not even when my little girl was murdered, you selfish, self-centered.
Harper's voice broke off abruptly. He was near tears, Melanie realized. Oh God, she'd driven her father to tears. He wiped his face with the back of a hand, quickly composing himself but still angry.
I'm going to the hospital. While I'm gone, I expect you two to give this some thought. And you, Melanie. I want an apology to both me and your mother by morning. And then you can start packing your bags. Because whether you like it or not, this whole family is going on vacation and we're all going to be happy if it kills us.
Harper banged through the French doors. Moments later, they could hear him storming down the hall and then slamming the front door. Then the house was silent. Patricia was staring at Melanie, who tried to think of something to say, something to do. She found herself fingering her cheek. It still stung. Her mind couldn't grasp it. She'd never seen her father violent before.
He just needs some time to cool off, Patricia murmured. He's been under a lot of pressure lately.
Melanie didn't say anything.
It's going to be all right, her mother said more anxiously. This is how families are. We have spells, bad spells, but we get through them, Melanie. We all get through them, and that's what makes us strong.
Maybe we shouldn't keep getting through them, Melanie said tiredly.
Maybe what this family really needs is to fall apart.
She staggered to her feet. Her legs felt rubbery. Pain gathered behind her left eyeball. Another migraine was coming.
You're only 29, her mother was saying. Only a 29-year-old would say something like that. The bottom line is that families must forgive, Melanie. And families must forget.
Why? We have never forgotten Megan. And you and Dad have obviously never forgiven each other. Or how could he have said even half of what he did?
What did you guys do back then?
What did you do? Patricia paled again. Then her shoulders sagged, and Melanie supposed she'd finally gotten what she wanted. Her mother broke, looking hurt and frightened beyond belief. Melanie decided there was no satisfaction in it after all. In her own room, the colors greeted her sharply. Red, green, and blue. Yellow and orange, and Lord, what a mess. She'd shed her dress and climbed into the shower, and there beneath the protective spray, she sobbed, simply because she needed to. When she climbed back out, all the emotion had drained away. She was no longer scared or angry or overwhelmed. She was exhausted. She took her Fioranil, cocooned herself in bed, and within seconds fell asleep. Once she woke up and saw her father standing in the doorway, his hands on his hips, his face filled with menace. Then she was sucked back into the darkness, where she ran through a dense underbrush, thorns snatching at her hair and the scent of gardenias cloying in the air.
I want to go home. I want to go home. Run, Megan. Run.
The sound of laboring breath coming closer, coming closer.
Run, Megan, run.
The gardenias, the branches, twigs, the heavy footsteps falling so close.
No.
When she woke up again, Patricia sat at her bedside, stroking her hair.
It's all right, her mother whispered. I won't lose another child. I won't.
23. David worked late. Hunched over his desk, he raked a hand through his hair and sifted through stacks of paper. His eyes were blurred by fatigue. His neck muscles ached and his lower back had locked up. He pushed himself harder, consumed by the notion that there wasn't much time left. Cheney had investigated William Sheffield's trash early that afternoon. He'd discovered an entire bag filled with pig organs, stained bedding, and one shiny apple. Unless Sheffield had taken up a macabre hobby, David was willing to believe the items had been left as some kind of shocking display. After 25 years, had one of the conspirators finally had enough? Or was there a person they had yet to identify? And what other kinds of messages might have been delivered that the Bureau simply didn't know about yet? David hated that question most of all. He was left with an overall feeling of being herded, that the messenger wasn't moving just with speed, but with competency. Hitting everyone's buttons and moving on, advancing them all through some highly complex game where he already had an ending in sight. That ending worried David quite a bit.
"What you got?"
he demanded from Detective Jax at 4 in the afternoon.
42 cases and 2 unidentified stiffs. And how are you?
Overworked and underloved.
Have you ID'd the shooter?
Nah. The tarot card reading came back inconclusive. Now I'm thinking of contacting a medium. Maybe get the guy's name and a song by Elvis Presley. You know, 'cause us local boys have nothing better to do with our time.
What about the payphone records? Know who Difford spoke to?
Yo, agent, keep your pants on. It takes a little while to subpoena public phone records and wade through the mess. Unless, of course, you want to do the paperwork for me.
It's your case,
David said stiffly.
As a matter of fact, it is. So why the hell am I talking to you?
Detective Jax hung up. Apparently, 42 cases took their toll on a man. David was left with gnawing frustration and a really bad mood. Subpoenaing records did take time. Sorting through the records of a downtown Boston payphone with its extraordinary high volume of calls took even longer. He just wanted answers now. 7 p.m. arrived. Larimore stopped by on his way out the door.
Where are we? Same as yesterday, plus 1 additional corpse.
Larimore scowled. David raised an inquiring brow.
Bad day, Larimore?
Bad week,
the supervisory agent said. David didn't push. Larimore's business was his own, just as David's business was his own. The red message light on his phone was already blinking with the 3rd message left by his father. After a moment, Larimore walked away. David returned to the open file on his desk. He was surrounded by stacks of materials, as if they were pieces of a giant jigsaw puzzle just waiting to fall into place. He had a file on the Stokes' financials, which he was dutifully compiling for his next 7 a.m. meeting with Larimore. Nothing revolutionary there. Money came in, money went out. Someone had better tell Harper there was more to life than Armani suits. David sighed. He'd left 2 messages with Brian Stokes, but neither had been returned. At 8 p.m., he paid a visit to the exiled son's house. No lights on, nobody home. Next, David tried the private practice where Brian worked, only to be told that the doctor had called in sick. 48 hours without a single sighting of Brian Stokes. David still wasn't sure what that meant. 9 p.m., he followed up with the lab. They didn't have conclusive news yet. No prints. Candles were a local-made brand available from a factory in Maine, and sold in several 100 locations in the state. The toy did seem old. Most interesting was the scrap of dress that had yielded 2 blood types. They were hoping to have DNA test results by end of week, and that was considered a rush job. Of course, for DNA results to be useful, you generally needed someone to match them against. Back to the normal investigative world of hurry up and wait. Nothing you can do anymore, Riggs. You are trying to help her. You are.
I lied to her,
he thought bluntly, finally left alone with his guilt. I never told her I was investigating her father, or that we probably do have a case against Harper for healthcare fraud.
That's your job. You have to do your job. That is how you help her.
What if it makes a difference? What if knowing that much about her father would give her perspective, help keep her safe?
You don't know that, Riggs.
As Cheney likes to say, there's still a world of difference between reckless endangerment of human life and hiring a hitman to kill your adopted daughter. He finally headed back to his place. He slipped on boxers, crawled into bed. He fell asleep with his pager cradled against his cheek, and he dreamed he was in a wooden shack but with Melanie, not Megan Stokes. He was cleaning, scrubbing the floor furiously as if that would save them all. But he could still see Melanie laid out in the middle of the floor, and no matter how hard he scrubbed, she didn't move. In the doorway, Russell Lee Holmes stood laughing. Chaney was tired. Really tired. He'd managed to snag an afternoon nap, but between trying to track down William Sheffield's garbage and his history at some boy's home in Texas, he'd still had a long day. At least he'd learned interesting information. According to one of the nuns, Sheffield had been a bit of a monster at that boy's home. She even thought William might have poisoned one of the older boys. Not enough to die, but enough to put some fear of God in the child and keep him away from William. Clearly, there was more to the thin, overeducated anesthesiologist than met the eye. Now, Chaney trudged through the dim halls of City General, pushing a cart loaded down with cleaning supplies, a giant trash can, and rolls upon rolls of toilet paper. Halls were empty, dimly lit. His cart echoed against the linoleum floor and gave him the willies. He didn't like big institutional places. When the ICU nurse had moved on to other patients in the ward, he'd managed to sneak a glance at the charts. He couldn't understand any of the shit. That was Riggs's department. He'd finally focused on two older patients who were hooked to heart monitors and IVs. One looked in pretty rough shape. Toothless jaw open beneath the oxygen mask. Skin settling into folds around her neck. Flesh tone nearly gray. Chaney figured whatever condition she had, it was real. The other man was younger. Probably in his 50s. Fairly fit, actually. Good haircut. Nice spring tan. A bit of a roll around the middle and upper arms. The next time the nurse was around, he'd inquire politely about the man's condition. Chaney turned the corner, slogging ahead and thinking he really had to get up to speed on healthcare fraud.
Oh, excuse me.
Chaney had been so lost in thought he'd run into a doctor. The man turned around, equally startled, and Chaney found himself face to face with Dr. William Sheffield. Chaney gripped the cart to hold himself steady. He was just a janitor, he reminded himself belatedly.
Are you going to move?
Sheffield inquired tersely. Chaney caught a faint whiff of whiskey.
Sorry.
Chaney eased back his cart. He had to stare at the floor now, or he was sure his face would give him away. Luckily, Sheffield wasn't in the mood to chat. The anesthesiologist brushed by in a snit and kept walking down the hall. Okay, now what? Chaney should swing back around to the ICU. Would Sheffield really strike two nights in a row? Anything was possible. Chaney picked up his footsteps, never seeing Sheffield turn around with a last annoyed glance, his gaze falling to the janitor's shoes. William took one look at the retreating Italian loafers, and his stomach plunged and his mouth went dry. He bolted into the nearest bathroom. He vomited into the sink. He grabbed the two vials of propanolol from his pocket, wiped them clean with paper towels, and shoved them deep into the trash can. Harper was setting him up, that son of a bitch. Looking for a fall guy so he could once again sail away into the sunset. Well, Harper Stokes had another think coming. William was not going down without a fight. Particularly not when he knew a thing or two.
We have problems, Harper stated at the other end of the line.
Would it kill you to let me sleep?
Jamie O'Donnell yawned, annoyed at being woken up for a second night by Harper. Jamie glanced at the clock glowing next to his bed. 2 a.m. Bloody hell.
Hang on.
Jamie pushed back the covers and crawled out of bed, conscious of Annie sleeping beside him. Jamie touched her cheek once, then picked up the phone and carried it with him to the adjoining room of the suite, shutting the door behind him so he wouldn't disturb her.
What's up, sport? Did you just get your tickets to Europe?
Jamie yawned again. The European vacation still rankled him, Harper riding off like the good cowboy with the tall white hat.
Fuck Europe, Harper said. This is about William. He's cracked. Called me in a total panic, told me he was being pursued by a pair of Italian loafers, and that he wasn't going to let me get away with this. And he slammed down the phone. I tried calling back twice, no answer. I went by his place, Looks as if a tornado was blown through and both William and his car have vanished.
You're right. The kid's gone Humpty Dumpty.
Jesus Christ, Harper exploded. He's ranting that I set him up. I've done no such thing. Just who the hell is behind all this? I thought you were going to figure it out.
I'm trying. As a matter of fact, I thought I'd talk to Larry Digger about it, but I couldn't. Seems that Larry boy is now dead.
What?
Oh, don't play dumb with me, Harper. I know you did it.
I did not! Harper sounded shrill. What the hell is going on? Somebody is setting me up, Jamie. You have to believe me. Somebody is just plain fucking with everything. My God, even Melanie came home accusing me of doing something to Megan.
For a moment, Jamie didn't reply. He'd never heard his old friend sound so out of control before, so genuinely afraid. He kept waiting for some feeling of satisfaction to come to him, but it didn't. He still carried the suspicion that this, too, was an act. It was always so difficult to tell with Harper.
You really didn't arrange to harm Larry Digger?
No!
Well, I didn't do it.
But...
Harper was definitely losing it now.
Who?
I don't know.
You have to fix this, Jamie. Everything is falling apart. It can't just happen like this. Not after all this time. It makes no sense. This was over and done with. End of story.
You started it again with the surgery, Hap. I warned you to keep your hands clean.
Fine. Fine, I'm stopping them. Just find Sheffield for me. Work this out with him.
What makes you think he'll listen to me? He hates me as much as anyone.
Because, Jamie, he's your kind, remember?
Jamie was silent. Then he had to shake his head. Leave it to Harper to lash out even when he was down. There was more than a bit of the street fighter in prim, proper Dr. Stokes.
All right,
Jamie said finally, reluctantly.
One last time. I'll take care of things. Just give me a day or two.
He added as almost an afterthought.
Oh, Harper.
What?
Have you spoken to your son lately?
No, I've been meaning to call. Tomorrow I'll do it.
Well, I wish you the best of luck then, old man, because I've been trying to reach him for 24 hours now, but Brian seems to have also disappeared. I wonder what that means, Hap. I wonder.
24. Melanie woke up with her cheek still stinging. She fingered the bruise gingerly. Painful, but nothing that wouldn't heal. She supposed that assessment characterized much of her life these days. When she came downstairs, the house was quiet. No Harper or Patricia. No Maria. She called her brother. Brian wasn't at home. She tried him at work. He was still out sick, the receptionist informed her. Something about a 48-hour flu bug. Melanie didn't believe that for a minute. If Brian was sick, he'd be at home. Now what? The phone call. The anonymous tip that supposedly had come from her own house. In the chaos of the past few days, she'd never followed up on it. Now she dialed the local phone company and arranged for a listing of calls to be sent. That would be a start. And until then? Melanie roamed the downstairs, feeling strange and outside her own skin. Her home looked like a setting from a play to her now. A carefully crafted backdrop. Living room hung in rose-colored silk, perfect for social gatherings. Front parlor with golden Italian marble, perfect for impressing hospital administrators. Dining room with the huge walnut table set for 12, perfect for family dinners and long, intimate conversations as the Stokeses unwound from their day. Back patio with its clay urns of climbing roses and wrought iron table, perfect for a father to strike a daughter. Enough. Melanie went down to the basement, where there rested a pile of boxes that shared one common label. Megan Stokes, 1968 to 1972. When Melanie had turned 12, Patricia lobbied to finish the basement as a rec room for the kids. Harper denied the motion. Families needed places to hide their junk, he'd insisted. Basements served useful purposes. It may have made sense, except the Stokeses had no junk. No boxes of old clothes, old books, jigsaw puzzles or games. No stained carpet or too old furniture. Harper was scrupulous. All outgrown items were cataloged, evaluated, and sent to the Salvation Army for the tax deduction. Everything had its worth. Except these boxes, whose content was priceless. She'd searched these boxes before, as a 9-year-old child desperate to learn more about her new parent's life. She'd run her child's hands reverently over the lace baptismal dress, the red velvet Christmas dress, the hand-knit pink blankie. She'd examine the small bronze shoes, the tiny handprint made in clay, the first works of Crayola art. She'd looked through the boxes feeling both guilty and enthralled, knowing she should stay away but consumed with the desire to know more. This was all that remained of Megan Stokes, and Melanie wanted to know about the real love in her family's life. Melanie began with the box of photos. They started with the Texas days. Jamie, Harper, and Patricia in an old white convertible. Jamie and Harper in pinstriped suits looking like 50s gangsters. Jamie with his arms wrapped around a young, beautiful Patricia, beaming at the camera. Jamie shaking his head while a dashing young Harper kissed his future wife. Wedding photos. Patricia and Harper inside a yawning cathedral, holding hands. Patricia wearing the perfect princess dress. Flounces and flounces of white tulle cascading down her slender frame. Outside with Jamie again, posing in a white tuxedo jacket with black trim as Harper's best man. Her godfather was still smiling, but now he stood far away from Patricia, often half cut out of the camera's lens. Despite what the three friends must have said, the wedding had changed things. Suddenly baby pictures. Brian Harper Stokes. February 25th, 1963. 8 pounds, 10 ounces. Brian being cradled in Harper's triumphant embrace. Patricia smiling tiredly. Brian crawling, Brian walking. 3-year-old Brian reaching for a figurine poised just out of his reach in a hallway. 3-year-old Brian looking stunned at the now broken statue. Patricia's notation. Brian's first encounter with art. When will he learn? Brian dressed up for Halloween as Satan. Brian still in his devil phase. At least it suits him. Then Patricia was pregnant. Brian faded to the background. The lens focused in on tall, slender Patricia now radiantly in bloom. Patricia cradling her stomach. Patricia in profile looking far away at something Melanie couldn't see. Patricia at a picnic. Brian running beside the blanket. Patricia very, very pregnant, holding up a stuffed bear for the camera. Brian's face barely visible behind her. Jamie's notation. Pat, 1968. Looking beautiful as always, lass. Melanie turned the page. Megan. Patricia cradling the newborn against her breast. The ruddy face pudgy and sleepy. The tiny little hand forming a tiny little fist. Brian sitting beside his mother and newborn sister. Jamie standing beside the hospital bed laughing, his thick finger securely caught in baby Megan's tight little fist. Suddenly, both Brian and Megan were growing up very fast. Picture of Brian feeding Megan, Brian reading to Megan. Brian pulling Megan in a little red wagon, beaming happily. 3 Halloweens later, Brian still dressed up as the devil, but Megan now at his side as Raggedy Ann. They were both smiling. Next photo, Patricia, Brian, and 4-year-old Megan Stokes, beaming into the camera. A beautiful young mother and her 2 incredibly happy, incredibly beautiful blonde children. Melanie put the album down. Her hands were shaking. She knew what happened next. A hot summer day in Texas. Patricia and Brian had left Megan with the nanny one morning to go to the doctor. And something had occurred that afternoon so that Megan Stokes ceased to exist on this earth. They really had been such a perfect family. There was no mention of Russell Lee Holmes in the box. No newspaper clippings of the case, not even condolence cards from the funeral. One page Megan Stokes beamed for the camera. The next she was gone. The end of the story never given. Melanie flipped through the book again. Jamie, Harper, and Patricia. Harper and Patricia. Baby Brian. Brian growing up, pregnant Patricia, baby Megan, Megan and Brian. Something niggled at the back of her mind. Pregnant Patricia, baby Megan, Megan and Brian. She couldn't get it. What she wanted haunted her, a word on the tip of her tongue, but she couldn't get it. Pregnant Patricia, baby Megan, Megan and Brian. Oh, Jesus. Where was Harper? Why wasn't there a single picture of her father with his new baby girl? Abruptly, a sound came from upstairs, the front door opening, then slamming shut. Footsteps on the floor above her head. Someone was home. Melanie scrambled to replace the photo album. The Megan boxes were sacred, and at the rate things were going these days, she didn't want to be caught rifling through them. More footsteps, crossing the hall into the living room, moving down the back